Today we head to Italy and speak with Dr. Simon Young, an authority on fairies, these unusual humanoids that have been recorded down through the ages. What are fairies? Where do they come from? And what is their influence on human beings? Fairies are documented in journals, in eyewitness accounts, and are seen around the world. But today, we're going to look at the UK, fairies in England, in Ireland, and, oddly enough, fairies that are located here in the United States. Later, we'll speak to Melissa Tittle on her take on fairies and their influence on our culture. And Adam Young has streaming media for your consumption from around the world. This is data that you can access directly from your internet. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, September 22nd, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how are you? This is Cliff, your host. Welcome to Earth Ancients. Yeah, you know what? Startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. Yeah, it's all happening here. It happens each Saturday, and we give you the news. I give you the news. The team here at Earth Ancients gives you the news. Hey, as you know, or as I have mentioned, this is Oktoberfest week. I've dusted off my lederhosen and my shoes and my clothing, and it officially starts tomorrow, September the 22nd. But here in California, we do a Friday version for those of us who can't do a Saturday version. I actually have two major events. I have the big one. It's called Oktoberfest by the Bay. It's held in San Francisco at Pier 48. And for those of you who are not familiar with Oktoberfest, it is probably the biggest beer bash in the world. It was originally started in the 17th century with King Ludwig's marriage to Princess Teresa, and it was a festival. He decided he wanted to have the local town townspeople of Munich join in the festivities, and it kept growing and growing. It went from a few days to a week, and then it just is insane. This year, it's Saturday the 22nd. It runs continuously in Munich to October the 7th, which is also a Saturday, and they consume thousands of gallons of beer over there. It's too much for me. But I will say that they are consuming, on the average, a liter per person, a couple of liters. And it's light beer. It's lager-style beer, which, 5% alcohol. So it's not going to knock you down too bad. But I tell you, if you keep drinking multiple liters, then it begins to affect you. And haven't been to Munich. I've been to other parts of Germany. Every time I get over there, it's either not happening, Oktoberfest hasn't started yet, or I've missed it. And I've seen pictures of literally groups of people passed out on the lawns that surround the massive tents that they put up for Oktoberfest. You can see a picture of me wearing my lederhosen. I'll put it up this weekend on the Facebook page. I've had those lederhosen about 20 years. And when I was a kid, my grandfather would celebrate Oktoberfest. We didn't have to wear the lederhosen, but he was very insistent that we understood what it was all about. And as a descendant of German heritage, it was a big deal. So we would have a nice meal and a couple of beers to celebrate Oktoberfest. So hey, here we go. Oktoberfest has started, and you all know that I enjoy my beer, and shoots the hell out of my diet, of course. So I'll have to go on a significant fast before I head to Mexico. And Mexico's coming up. The tour is coming up. So anyhow, welcome to Oktoberfest. Have a beer. Yeah, I did want to mention that the tour to Mexico, the Sacred Pyramid Tour, is November 17th through the 24th. We're full. If you want to squeeze yourself in, we have a couple spots left. Go to earthancients.com/tour, and you'll see the itinerary for this Yucatan, Mexico trip. Now, I was looking at some recent research done on the tunnels they discovered there. And most of the world knows about the Kukulcan pyramid, which is the main pyramid. The Spanish, when they came there, they named it the El Castillo, the castle, because it was so big and so beautifully constructed. But what we are learning about these pyramids is that they are machines. And a couple of years ago, NASA was down in Chichen Itza, site of the El Castillo, and they were doing their own scans. And a lot of information came up. A lot of it was not provided, and it's still not provided, because I think they found some really unique emissions coming out of this pyramid. And the reason that I believe they found emissions, or another word would be for they'd find telluric energy fields, that's another way of putting it, is because there is an active cenote underneath that also is connected to a river. And we don't know how this machine works, but I do know that when I was able to climb it about 15 years ago, that when I got to the top, I was blasted with what felt like an energy charge that was so significant that I had to basically stay up there for a good half an hour just to kind of adjust to this feeling. And for those of you who are lucky enough to come with me on this trip, you'll hopefully experience that too in a couple of the locations we go to. But what they have discovered, what scientists have discovered, is that the Maya built a series of tunnels that connect the smaller pyramids that are located at Chichen Itza. And these tunnels interconnect in a labyrinth. And their thinking right now is that these were used for people to crawl in and this kind of stuff. That's a bunch of crap. What these tunnels were used for, and we see it at Teotihuacan, at the Kukulcan pyramid there, and in Egypt, and in other places that have this pyramid technology. Water is a conductor, and so water is pushed into these was pushed into these tunnels and flows underneath the tunnel, picking up the telluric energy, amplifying it, passing it up through the pyramid. And by the way, most of these pyramids have stones that have quartz in them that are conductors. And so it amplifies the energy and pushes it up. Now, how the energy was used, we don't have a clue. The books were burned. All the codices that have information were burned. And all we can tell now is that if you climb on these pyramids at certain times of day, you get blasted. So obviously, my mentor, Humbats Men, who passed away, who was a Mayan shaman, told me that in certain cities, certain energy was used to do certain things. Now, he believed, and it was handed down to him, that Uxmal, which is on the other side of the peninsula, closer to the Gulf of Mexico, was used for enhancing libido. That's another word for sexuality. And when you go to Uxmal, there are buildings that have little rooms in them. And he said that these rooms were used for meditative purposes, for bathing in this energy, for sexual initiation. You know, and we think of sexuality today, we've perverted it, you know, because it's like, oh, it's like porno. It's porno. You're thinking of, you know, erections and stimulation and orgasms. And, well, I mean, that's all important to them thousands of years ago, but more in a full body spectrum kind of a point of view, which means that they were looking at the whole organism and the positives and the negatives, how to flow energy in their bodies, how to enhance their bodies, how to remove disease, how to keep balance. And these are what the ancients were all about, is connecting with earth energy. So these pyramids are energy fields. And what they found, again, in these tunnels is waterways. And I've talked about waterways off and on for a while. So I'm actually writing a book about this. I've started it, and I'm going to get into more details. The real problem I'm finding with current science is that they look at these things as, oh, they were tunnels for the death, or they were tunnels to put the dead. Because we are still behind on energetic fields, being able to detect them, being able to understand how they affect the body, we're probably, you know, a good 50 to 100 years behind the advanced nature of these pyramids, how they worked, why are they a machine, how they interacted with the body. Now, my belief, and this is kind of stretching a little bit, is that it all kind of connects with probably some form of machinery. Now, I have observed and written a deal. In fact, you can read the articles I've written on the ancientorigins.com magazine. I wrote an article about the observatory, the El Caracol, the snail at Chichen Itza. And there, not only is water passed underneath that facility, there were panels that were pushed and articulated up and to the top and around the sides of that building that probably held various visual aids. And I want to say things like telescopes, but I'm more inclined to say that these panels probably held optical equipment, optical instruments that were able to measure distance of the different planets around them, around Earth. And if you look at the remaining books, the codices, they have great detail about the orbits of the Venus and Mars and the Moon that aren't simply done from standing and looking at the sky. They had equipment. And a lot of this information was handed down to them too. So anyhow, they're still observing these tunnels. And there's a labyrinth of them. We get bits and pieces. I have some photographs I'm going to post on Facebook with details about this discovery and what these tunnels look like. And they're part of the mechanics of these pyramids. And these pyramids were machines. And that's the way it is. That's just how it is. And we need to come up to speed on this stuff. So really fun. Excited to be going down. I try to go every year. And if you can join me, great. If you can't, I will be recording each day a little bit of information, and I'll compile it on the weekly show. Definitely will be pushing it out to Facebook and those of you who follow me on the Earth Ancients pages, international and local. And I'm going to be interviewing some of the guests that we have along. We have people coming from around the world to this tour, and it's a blast because we have special access not only to the pyramids, but to some of the most recent excavations and consolidation. This is when they began to take these stones, take the blocks, and like a jigsaw puzzle, begin to re-erect them, re-place them. As they once stood. And it's really fun to see that because, you know, things are slow in Mexico, and it's a country that's financially strapped. And when they do begin to consolidate, it's a big deal because Not only do the experts come and begin working, but they get local specialists that have, and even some of the local Maya people to help put these buildings back together. And it's fun to watch. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up in November. Earth Ancients is brought to you by Audible, and Audible is offering a 30-day free trial for anyone who signs up. And when you do sign up, they're also giving you your first book for free. And that's any size book. It can be a monstrous book. It can be a book that is in sections or different volumes. But you can go to Audible right now and sign up, and you will get your first book free. And I keep telling you that I don't have time to read. And a lot of these authors we have in the program, they write tomes. They write 400, 500, 600-page books, and I don't have time to read it. In fact, I use books that size as paperweights. So check it out. Go to audibletrial.com/earthancients. Sign up, get on board, and download your first book. Hey, get Graham Hancock's last book, Magician of the Gods, and he is actually narrating, which is really fun. And I really love that about Audible. When possible, they have the author read his or her book and narrate it to you, the listening audience. So check it out, audibletrial.com/earthancients. It's really the way to go. It's really the future, because I listen to a lot of books when I'm driving too. Hey, we just announced a new tour. This is in America. It's called Spirit Journey into the Orion Zone. It's May 17th through the 20th. It is going to be we're going to have a home base of Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is going to be a really important tour. I've been wanting to go and see Chaco Canyon, the Aztec ruins in the Mesa Verde area. And we're going to go with a number of experts, and we're going to be guided by a number of native elders who will talk to us about the petroglyphs that are there, their wall writings, the importance of these kivas, these massive structures that are built on telluric fields, and there'll be some ceremony going on too. Hey, we're also going to be hanging with Gary David, who's written a lot about the native culture and its connection to the Orion constellations. Again, May 17th through 20th, we're only going to take a handful of people. It's 4 days of really fun exploration, exploring monumental archaeology, architecture, and sacred sites of the ancient Pueblo people that are in that area. So if you're interested, it is amazing. I think you're really going to like it. Go and send me an email. Send it to cliff@earthancients.com. Say you'd like to get more information, and I'll send you a link. This is something I've been wanting to do. I think it's unique, and it is in the United States. So you can learn about the native traditions and their connection to the stars, May 17th through the 20th. I want to mention my guest next week is Richard Casero. We've had Richard on the program before. Talking about ancient cultures and their connection to each other. The diffusion theory is strong in his hypothesis. He has a new book coming out on the Maya in a few weeks, and we're going to talk about this new book. Of course, I'm always interested in anything regarding the Maya, and Richard has spent a significant amount of time down there in Central America, studying not only the pyramids, but also traditions of different people, but specifically the Maya. So stay tuned for that. That'll be our last show for the month of September. That'll be September the 29th. Really excited about today's guest, Dr. Simon Young. Simon was calling to us from Italy, and I was pleasantly surprised to learn that he is the foremost authority on the fairy people, the fair people of not only the UK, but a lot of the research he's done is on fairy sightings and interactions with these super beings, these unusual humanoids here in the United States. So this is going to be a fun discussion. Hey, support Earth Ancients. Support Earth Ancients with a subscription to Patreon. For as little as $5 a month, you support the work we do here on the program. Now, we're in the works to start to launch a new podcast called Destiny. And Destiny is all about enhancing the human condition, enhancing body, mind, and spirit through a number of ancient practices, not just yoga, not just meditation, but working with medicine plants, working with states of consciousness, and everything in between. This is the new program. It's called Destiny. You're going to hear about it here on Earth Ancients in the coming weeks. And this is something I've been wanting to do for years, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But hey, we need your support, and your support helps in the form of $5 a month or more. And when you go to Patreon, not only do you support the development of Earth Ancients and future programming, but you also get a lot of free stuff. We have ebooks that you can download. We have music. We have galleries. And there's a number of interviews that I have not published on the regular podcast simply because they're not appropriate and they are not fitting, but they have their place, and that's why I'm offering it to you on the Patreon page. To become a subscriber, go to Patreon, patreon.com/Earth Ancients, and just register and you become a subscriber. Hey, when you register, you support everything we're all about. Okay, here's today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Check in with Melissa Tittle. Melissa sits on top of the mountain in the high plains of Colorado. She is the director of content for Gaia, and we want to check in with her. Hey, how you doing, Melissa?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's Friday. I'm happy. Hey, so this week we're doing fairies. We're talking with the foremost authority on the fairy people, and I was quite intrigued to learn that they're not just small folk. There's the banshees, the bogarts, the brownies, the gremlins, the pixies, and the leprechauns. And according to our guests this week, they all are in the fairy realm. So what do you know about the fairy realm?
That is the first time somebody has asked me that question. So I should be honored. What do I think of the fairy realm? I think it's really interesting, and I think it's part of our human psyche, honestly. I think that the idea of fairies, it sounds kind of crazy, but I actually think that it makes more sense than some of the other stuff. Like, it actually makes more sense than Bigfoot sometimes to me.
Yeah.
And the reason is because I feel that we all have this very – everyone has a vivid imagination, and fairies seem harmless but yet mischievous at the same time. It's almost like they exist. We can't see them. We want to believe in them. We have like all these folklore about them. Maybe when you meditate, you see things that look like fairies. Mm-hmm. You have entertainment that always portrays different kinds of fairies, like, you know, Lord of the Rings and stuff like that.
Exactly.
But for some reason, although it sounds crazy, it seems actually more tangible. Like, it is literally a part of our human collective consciousness, the belief in fairies and the fact that they are around us.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I brought up that same topic about Bigfoot. I mean, we hear about them, we see bits of hair, we have really bad photographs of a Bigfoot or Sasquatch, but no one really has captured one. We've never seen the bones or the remains of a Sasquatch. It's really, really strange. So I think the fairy, you're right, the fairies kind of fall in the same area of they're there, but are they?
Right. But, you know, are they, I was just talking to somebody about this. I had somebody like look at my apartment to see if there was any weird stuff going on in like interdimensionally. It was just like, you know.
Energetics are weird on your apartment, huh?
Yes. Okay. I work in Gaia, so there's a lot of people that come through here and I can ask these questions too. So
yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
And they said that there are a bunch of orbs that exist. And I'm like, well, I don't see them. And they're like, you should try to take pictures of your place and see if they exist. And this person was telling me that the orbs are a representation of this fairy realm. And they have different energies. And that's why sometimes you see them in like different colors and stuff. And these are definitely mischievous ones. So they, and I'm like, why do I have mischievous fairies in my place? And
you're there close to native areas. You need to do a blessing and have the smoke coming out of the sage. You got to sage your place. You got to get rid of that energy. You've heard about that, right?
Yeah, of course. But yeah. But apparently they're not bad. They're not.
Oh, okay.
They're not doing anything. They're just they're like tricksters, sort of.
So you're waking up with your mattress and pillows all thrown all over the place and the plate.
That's like poltergeist. This is just okay.
You're feeling weird vibes in your place, huh?
Yeah, I don't feel like it's I don't feel like it's like bad. I do feel that there's just like little things there, and it's funny because my dog will just start barking at something. But now this makes more sense.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't mean that there's actual evidence, right? Like there's sort of evidence with Bigfoot, sort of not evidence, you know. It's just in that weird space. But for some reason, if somebody would have told me, hey, there's a Bigfoot that's over there in Chautauqua Park in Boulder, I would believe that less than the fact that there's fairies in my apartment.
Okay. Hey, before I let you go, have you done any specials on fairies with Gaia or Ancient Aliens or any of the production companies you work with?
For mainstream, no. For Gaia, okay. We definitely have had experts that have come here to talk on some of like Open Minds and Beyond Belief about fairies.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Fantastic. All right, Melissa.
All right.
You have a wonderful weekend and we'll catch you next week.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Time to check in with Adam Young. Adam is our disseminator of information. Tons of streaming media out there. So much to look at. Adam brings it into focus each week on our segment. So, hey, Adam, how you doing, man?
Good. How are you, Cliff?
I'm good. I'm really good. So we got three topics this week, three parts of the world. Let's start off with Musk reveals SpaceX first moon tourist. He's a Japanese billionaire. This just came out the other day. It's pretty interesting. So what's the story?
Yeah, earlier in the week, he announced that they had a press conference, and the gentleman's name is Yusaku Maezawa, I believe. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be the first private citizen to not go into space, because I think someone did that already, but to go actually to the moon. They're going to go around the moon. They didn't make it clear exactly what the logistics would be, because the rocket actually hasn't been built yet. But if he does orbit the moon, it'd be interesting to see how many times, if he's able to get photographs, particularly of the dark side, because as you know, the moon does not rotate around an axis. It's actually always showing the same side towards Earth. So if there is anything interesting on the dark side, we generally don't see it because of the light and because it's not visible from Earth.
I got to ask you this, though. I mean, doesn't NASA have something to say about this? Because they're going to have, they're going to be exposed. I mean, they're going to have big windows on this ship. You can look down. You can take photographs. That's all they need to do is have the ruins of a city exposed. And then it's like, what the hell?
Well, we'll see. I don't know. I mean, that whole water situation a couple of weeks ago was ridiculous, how there was water discovered or announced by India that NASA had never really revealed before. But anyway, this gentleman will be allowed to bring up to eight friends. And I say friends in quotations because he says he's bringing artists with him and other social commentators or something. So I'm not exactly sure what the reasoning is behind that. But he's marketing it as like a way to bring people together and create world peace. So I wonder what his motivations are. Yeah. You know, but they will be taking photographs and collecting other evidence. So
you
we'll
know
see.
It. The thing that I thought was interesting, I caught part of this article, is they didn't reveal the cost, and it must be several million per person.
I think it's a lot more than that.
Oh, is it like in the tens of millions, you think?
It's like I think it's going to cost around $1 billion. The rocket itself is much bigger than the other SpaceX rocket. So this one's going to be 110 meters by like 9 meters in diameter.
Well, I'm talking about the actual cost of the tourists, the first moon tourists, what the price.
Everything.
Would be. Oh,
yeah,
really?
I mean, it's what this guy's paying. I think he's probably paying close to $1 billion. Yeah, they didn't talk about it yet, but that's the estimates are that even
outrageous.
With his economies of scale.
Oh,
well,
man.
It's still like about a 20th the price of how NASA would pay for it. But
and what was the estimated date that this first private space tourist rocket would shoot off the planet Earth?
I think it's in early 2023, so at least 4 years, potentially 5 years.
God, that's going to be great. That's going to be so great. I mean, this is what I'm waiting for this. I'm waiting for the Chinese, the Indians. I'm waiting for anybody who can get a rocket up outside of NASA to orbit not only the moon. I want to see them orbit Mars. That's going to be the eye opener.
Yeah, I believe China has actually landed a craft on the moon, but I don't think they haven't sent any humans there yet.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. All right. The next one is title is Was There a Civilization on Earth Before Humans? What's that all about?
OK, we discussed this a couple of months back. There was a current NASA employee and scientist who published this paper that was published in a physics journal. And it discusses a Silurian hypothesis, which is basically detecting ancient civilizations on Earth before humans. It talks a lot about the geological record and how you would actually do that. But this guy seems to be a believer that there may have been high degrees of civilization before us. And he actually says the probability of that is like close to one, like 100% probability that in the distant past, humans had been very highly advanced. But he goes on to say it might not have been humans as we know it. And this is one of the weaknesses of the article, is that it clearly states in there that humans are 300,000 years old, which I think that date is a little bit questionable and it keeps getting pushed back. But he uses that to say it might not be humans as we know them. It could be something else. It could be another form of hominid.
So he has a nice premise, but he kind of muddies the water with some bad thought, is what you're
saying. A little bit, but it's still very nice because they do put some boundaries around it. So, for instance, they say the oldest stretch of ancient surface on the planet is 1.8 million years old, meaning that hadn't been recovered or, you know, deeply buried. And ancient sediment. So 1.8 million years is kind of like a boundary limit. So it would be nearly impossible to detect any society or high level of society beyond that 1.8 million year boundary. So it goes on to say, all right, well, what can we actually look for? So the best way to detect what is left behind is to look for things that the society would have been doing and leaving as byproducts. So for instance, today, we have like things like fertilizer for crops. So you'd be redirecting nitrogen from where it would naturally be found. So you can try to detect like excess quantities of nitrogen. Other things like rare earth metals that are used in electronics and for production and manufacturing. Also things like synthetic steroids, drugs that would not naturally decompose, including things like plastics, even though plastic does eventually degrade because it's carbon-based, but and then carbon in the atmosphere itself. So, you know, the 300,000-year thing for modern humans could be a little bit off, but something that's slightly non-human like Neanderthal, Denisovan, things like that, I think would be a little bit more relevant.
That's interesting. So, yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah. I think, though, what he, the point he leaves out, or he leaves us with, excuse me, at the end here, is actually kind of profound. And I'll read you the quote. Once you realize through climate change the need to find lower impact energy sources, the less impact you will leave. Right. So in other words, as these societies got more and more advanced, they would actually be probably living more in harmony with the planet and leaving less evidence of their existence.
I've always thought that myself. I think that we live in such an artificially reality with our plastics and our cements and our polymers and all that kind of crap. I mean, we're everywhere. But an earlier, like the Maya were very focused on living as close to the earth as possible. And most Native American cultures are the same way. They live by the earth and they don't really leave a footprint. So what if that's the case with these earlier civilizations? They were very naturalistic in their evolution. What would be a means of detecting their presence? So that's a good question.
I mean, they have left giant monolithic and megalithic works of stone that were built to last, right? These things were, a lot of these things were built to survive for millennia, if not longer.
Yeah.
And we can play detective a bit by trying to figure out how they might have been constructed and to what end. And that will reveal a little bit about what their science was based on, how, you know, advanced their culture had gotten in terms of science, engineering, and learning. So,
yeah. And you've been to Pumapunku too. And that's a very good example of very, very, very sophisticated, perhaps equally as sophisticated as the Great Pyramids in the Giza Plateau. So there is evidence of spots here and there around the world that do show evidence of extreme sophistication, perhaps tens of thousands of years ago. So there you go.
Some of the Indian stuff seems to actually be a little bit more explicit in the reference to technology, like in showing, in showing telescopes and actually implements of the tech that are still there. And even, I don't know how old some of these carvings may be, but it seems like you know, the Indian culture was equally as advanced, if not more so, than some of the other ones.
Yeah, I agree. All right, we move on. Our final post for this week, the Adam Young review, is the new Colossus statue, which is in India. And this is produced by a woman named J.J. Ainsworth. So talk a little bit about it. This is a video you can see on YouTube, by the way.
She did publish it on YouTube. It's a couple minutes long, and it's a high, I would say, high def home movie of these Colossus statues. And if you have been to Egypt, you may have seen them. I don't know how long ago a listener may have been there, but more recently, there is an American archaeological expedition that's working right behind the two famous ones, and they've uncovered a whole bunch more, and they're in these pairs, like sets of two, all the way down the road for a couple of miles. So they line up, and a lot of the other ones that they've been finding are almost as big or similar size to the two main ones that everyone's seen. So these used to be regarded as the largest freestanding stone statues on Earth, or they were before they were, I guess I'll say, quote unquote, destroyed. Because when you go there, and this is why the video is so interesting, pay close attention to the cracks and the fissures in the rock. These were pieced back together. They were found in pieces, and the other ones that are discovered are buried in sediment, so they're being reformed, essentially. But they were not like chiseled apart or whacked apart with a sledgehammer. They're in roughly equal pieces. So let's say, you know, multi-ton pieces, 5 to 10 tons per stone, but almost like equally cut. So what sort of force could take a statue and break it into equal pieces? Like what possible method or what sort of, you know, mass or explosive or whatever could do this? And the last time I was there, I've been there a few times, I was there with Muhammad Ibrahim, and his point of view was it must have been something potentially related to a cataclysm. So think, you know, giant plasma outbursts from the sun or just tremendous amount of energy to almost implode these things.
Yeah, when I look at those photographs, I was thinking, well, would this be the action of a tsunami and water? They're just too damn big. And I think when you say an implosion or some kind of an explosion of a great force, that would be the only way you could rip granite apart like that. Because, and this is for you listeners, when you see the video, we're looking at massive pieces of hand, massive sculptures of hands and arms. I mean, I'm looking at a hand, a fist, that is as big as a house. It's huge. It's just massive. And how in the hell did that break away from the rest of the body? It was something exploded, it looks like.
How were they gotten there? I mean, these things would have been as big as the Trilithon stones in Lebanon. Like, you know, we're talking 1,500 plus tons.
Yeah.
How were they moved here? And there's not just two. Yeah. Turns out there's like 15 or 20.
Yeah, which is fascinating.
This is very close to Valley of the Kings, in case anyone's interested. Valley of the Kings is in the mountain range that's, I think, adjacent to this or, you know, within a short drive. Mm-hmm. And Valley of the Kings is another subject, which we can talk about later. But there's hundreds of these precisely intricately carved geometric sort of caves that a few bodies were found in later on.
yeah. Interesting. Adam, as always, a great lineup. You can see these three suggestions. Look on the Facebook page or earthancients.com. Look for the weekly banner with Dr. Simon Young and the interview. And just below it will be Adam's list of references. So there you go. Adam, as always, excellent. And we will talk to you next week.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks.
Today's interview is brought to you by A Journey to the Land of the Maya, the Sacred Pyramid Tour, November 17th to the 24th. This is the groundbreaker. This is the one you want to get on if you want to know about the Maya. See the pyramids, see these ancient cities, and get involved. This is a chance to join me and a small party of people. We are based in Mérida. We just added a new dimension. We've added Miguel Angel, who is a Mayan shaman. He will join us Monday, the 19th of November, and be with us for the full day. We'll be going to Uxmal and another city, and we are going to have a great time. This is all about discovery. If you're interested in joining me, go to earthancients.com/tours and go to Maya in Mexico, and you will see the entire itinerary. Register as soon as you can. We're just about filled. We got a few spots left. We're keeping it small so we can get around. We travel in an air-conditioned bus. The hotel is amazing. The food's fantastic. And it is a guided tour. You'll see the best of the best cities from the ancient past. We'll have a chance to hang out, and we have a great time. So again, November 17th through the 24th this year, the Sacred Maya Tour. Come out and join me. So as most of you know, we travel the world looking for evidence of ancient and unknown civilizations. This week, we're touching upon a kind of a different point of view of beings on Earth. We're looking at the fairy world, the world of unusual small people. They're considered brownies, gremlins, pixies, leprechauns, banshees. Unusual, small, fair people. And I am really honored to have perhaps the foremost expert on fairies, Simon Young, with us today. Simon is a British historian. He's based in Italy. And he specializes in supernatural beliefs. We're going to have to ask him a few questions about that. His recent book includes Magical Folk, British and Irish Fairies, 500 AD to the present. And that was co-written. He actually edited this book with Sherry Holbrook. And also a collection of fairy lore essays, The Fairy Census. And we're going to get into this. This is interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, if these are actual beings, where do they come from? How are they connecting to us as humans, Homo sapiens sapien? Are they a branch of Homo sapiens sapien, which would be fascinating to know about? And many other questions we have regarding just how fairies impact us and what they're all about. Simon Young, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
All right. Hey, listen, you undertook perhaps the biggest fairy lore survey of its kind. It's part of the Fairy Investigation Society. What got you involved with something like that? What was it? Was it part of your thesis, or how did you get involved with kind of decoding what fairies are all about?
Well, I became fascinated about 6 or 7 years ago in folklore and fairy lore. And I was particularly interested in people who claimed that they had seen fairies. Because for me, this was just something which, it was something that I found very difficult to deal with in my own head. The idea that someone can go out walking or someone begin lying in bed and they actually see something which they claim is a fairy. Right. And in looking at this stuff, I discovered a fascinating woman named Marjorie Johnson, who was an English woman born just after the First World War. And she had spent her entire life collecting fairy stories, but from people who'd actually had fairy experiences. And Marjorie Johnson also had seen fairies throughout her life. And she gathered all of these different experiences together in one book. And she never managed to publish these experiences in English. And unfortunately, she died just when she was past 100, having never done this. Very, very lucky in that I was able to get my hands on this manuscript. And so I was able to get this manuscript published. And so you can imagine that what you have here is, 400 sightings from really around the world, but particularly from the UK and from the US, of people who claim to have seen fairies, stretching from the 1890s all the way through to the 1980s. And I guess that once I published this, I asked myself, well, people are still seeing fairies because people write to me. Why don't I do the same thing that Marjorie Johnson did, but using social media, using the internet, using networks online? Mm-hmm. And that's what I set out to do. And with the Fairy Census, I managed to gather in about 500 sightings from around the world.
Okay, that's pretty significant. Now, let's go back just a little bit. You're a historian. But you specialize in supernatural beliefs. Tell me a little bit about that. Was that something that you decided to touch upon? Because you devoted your academic life to this topic, it sounds like.
Well, so I originally studied other things. And then when I was in my mid-30s, I'm now in my mid-40s, I had, let's say, a serious health event. And I really became very ill. Mm-hmm. And I went through, as so many people do, of course, but a very rocky couple of years where things were just getting worse and worse. And I was very lucky that I came out of this in one piece and things got better. And once I'd come through this dark tunnel, I just didn't really want to go back to studying what I'd studied before. Mm. And so I guess I looked around, and I'd always been, and I still am, quite a skeptic, but I find supernatural experiences fascinating, and I've had lots of enjoyable conversations over the years with people who've had supernatural experiences, and I particularly found the idea of fairies fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so I began to study them as a kind, I suppose, almost as a personal therapy after this pretty traumatic time. But then, a passion takes hold of you. Before I knew it, I was staying up to all hours writing about this. I was publishing articles on it, and I think I just fell in love with the subject.
Wow. Let's talk about a fairy. I'm looking at your website here. It says, briefly, a fairy is a supernatural living humanoid, which is basically the best short answer that you give. But you've had or you've compiled a ton of eyewitness accounts of interactions with these beings. Tell us as succinctly as possible, what is a fairy?
Well, I like that definition there. I wrote it about 4 or 5 years ago, but I would stand by it. I mean, what you're basically dealing with, okay, you've got something supernatural. So this is not going to be something like you and me that you can touch, that you can interact with easily in a physical way. Second, it is alive. And the reason I include that is that fairies are not ghosts. At least in the vast majority of accounts, they have nothing to do with ghosts. Usually they're connected to places, the landscape, maybe buildings, but they're connected to places. They're not spirits of the dead, typically. And then the other thing is, they are usually humanoids. Now, when you were introducing us, you mentioned that they are typically small. And I think there's some truth in that. But you get fairies of all sizes. You get fairies ranging from giants down to fairies that are the size of midges, the size of mosquitoes. So I stand by that. I like it's they're supernatural. They're magical, if you like. They're not ghosts as we understand the world, and they usually have some kind of a human form, humanoid, to use the word you used before.
Okay, so I'm going to get a little drilled down a little bit more as a researcher. Because so many people don't see these beings, can we think of them as dimensional beings that show up at a certain time of day? Does the viewer have to have a certain mindset? I mean, what are the conditions that these beings are seen?
Okay, well, let me say, first of all, when I did the fairy census, this, in a sense, was my entire aim. I wanted to know, really, not what fairies are, because as far as I'm concerned, that's just a hopelessly difficult question for mere human beings. But what I wanted to know was what kind of people see fairies. And that's where we click into all the things you've just mentioned. I mean, what time of day, under what kind of conditions? The fairy census actually asks a lot of questions. I think there are about 36 questions. And one of them, for example, is what time of day approximately did you see the fairy, or did you have this fairy experience? Mm-hmm. And you can imagine that there are a number of patterns that come out of this. And let me just give you a few. I mean, let's imagine someone wants to see a fairy. What are the things that help? And you and your listeners can make of this what you will. Well, first of all, the best category to be in is to be a child between the age of, say, 3 and 10. And to be
okay.
You get lots of accounts from people who are 40 or 50 or 60 or 80 and remember seeing fairies when they were, say, 6 or 7. That those are probably the single biggest category, and the category I find the most fascinating. Other things, girls see fairies or see these supernatural creatures more than boys. Women see them more than men. There's a huge difference there. I mean, my memory is that among children, 80% of those that see fairies are girls. And then there are other things. You will see fairies. I mean, you won't see them on a motorway. You're unlikely to see them in the middle of a town. The places that people see fairies tend to be green places, gardens, woods. And then the other place to see fairies, and once again, I invite you to come to your own conclusions with this, but is in bedrooms, because lots and lots of people who see fairies are going to sleep, have just woken up, are walking from the bathroom to the bedroom. They're in a state where they're, let's say, getting ready to nod off.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And what do we know about these fairies? And when I say what do we know, specifically, do they convey what their role is on Earth? Are they here doing their work to I don't know if they make a living. Do they have a community? What do we know about the typical fairy community that is that we can understand?
Yeah, well, look, it all depends not just who you ask, but when you ask. Because if you ask this question 500 years ago, you know, let's imagine that we go to a village in the middle of France and say, you know, what are these fairies? What are they about? The people in that village would have said to you, well, the fairies are our neighbours. And the fairies just live off to the side of human settlements, and they're kind of a mirror of human settlements. And the weird thing is that all the accounts suggest that the fairies need us because we help them with various things. For example, human midwives help fairies give birth. But also we need the fairies. And the things that the fairies do for us in these medieval societies is they help things grow. They help with fertility. They help the crops to come out. And that idea, in a slightly strange way, has survived through to the modern day. And when you talk to people who believe or claim that they've talked to fairies, they usually, not always, but usually identify fairies as being the spirits of the land. Yeah. So, for example, Marjorie Johnson, who I mentioned before, this fascinating woman who literally had a lifelong relationship with fairies. I mean, she spoke to them every day. She sincerely believed there were fairies that lived in her house. She believed that fairies were the spirits of trees, that they were the spirits of flowers, that they were the spirits of the natural world.
Fascinating. Now, you define these types of fairies, and I mentioned this in the very beginning. Now, you have banshees, bogarts, brownies, gremlins, hikey spirits, ginny, green teeth, leprechauns, and then finally pixies. Is there one that's seen more than the other? I mean, I was kind of pleasantly surprised to see these variations, but obviously you have them because people describe them in enough detail so that they have their own existence. So what do we know about all these different fairies?
Well, look, I think to keep things simple, and I think in the end it is actually quite simple. The bottom line is this. We use the word fairy to describe these supernatural beings who live in communities, in the landscape, who are this strange mirror of our societies. And what happens is the name changes depending where you go. So again, if you were in France 500 years ago, depending on the different region you went to, there would have been a different name for these supernatural creatures.
Ah, I get you.
Okay. And so the way I would interpret it is to say that, for example, the pixies are the fairies of Cornwall and Devon, yeah, which is southwestern England. And if you go to another region of England, for example, the Midlands, you might hear them called the Pharisees. Yeah, a different name again. So fairies, if you like, is the generic term. It's the Homo sapiens for describing all the group. But then in different regions, there are different names for them. And what's happened over the centuries is that fairy has slowly pushed out the other terms.
Understood. I've seen videos and photographs of people who believe they've taken photographs of or images of fairies. In fact, I think in an England museum there is the skeletal remains of what looks like a fairy. It had wings or something. Do we have any physical evidence that you're aware of that you document of fairies?
Right. Well, again, it would depend what you mean by physical evidence. I mean, one thing that we have a lot of are photographs and films of people claiming to see fairies. And I mean, they stretch back all the way to the First World War. And I think it would be possible and it would be a lot of fun to actually do a book looking at these photographs and films, and trying to explain them, or just throwing up our hands in despair at being unable to do, to explain them. But as far as physical artifacts go, if you like, things of fairies that we can touch, there are some beautiful fake skeletons around. And I mean, this is something that 2 minutes on Google, you'll turn up quite a few of these. And some of them are, I mean, fabulously made, made with, you know, great care and attention. It looks like a huge butterfly with a small humanoid skeleton. The thing that has survived in terms of, let's call them relics, are there are some objects that are found in various places, sometimes in museums, sometimes in family homes, of objects that were said to belong to the fairies. And this is as physical as you're really going to get. For example, there is a tradition of fairy shoes surviving in Ireland. There is a tradition of a fairy coat surviving from Ireland. And this is something which, I mean, just this spring, an American researcher was actually trying to track down this fairy coat that had been around as late as the 1970s. There is a castle in Scotland where a fairy flag survives. And one member of the aristocratic family from this castle flew in British Bomber Command in the Second World War. And allegedly he took a small fabric from this flag as a good luck charm while he was in this plane. If any of your listeners are traveling to London, in the British Museum, there is a beautiful glass cup which is called the Luck of Edenhall, which was stolen by a Cumbrian. Cumbrian, this is northwestern England, a Cumbrian way back in the 15th century. And he claims he nicked it from the fairies, that he grabbed it from the fairies. Now, unfortunately for this story, the cup is actually a 14th century glass object made in Syria in the Middle East. It was probably brought back from the Crusades. But it's one of these things where you desperately don't want to spoil a good story with the truth.
Yeah, that's funny. If you were to place fairies on an evolutionary scale, or in terms of a human evolution, we have the we're considered Homo sapiens sapiens, and then there's different branches before, and who knows what the future holds. Where would these little beings be if you were to place them somewhere? Are they like? I mean, because obviously we don't have a body, we don't have a skull. Are they part of the genus, the family of humanoids?
Well, listen, I think I'll answer that in two parts if I can. First of all, I'll give you the folklorist answer. The fairies mirror humans. They evolve with us, if you like. So if you look at descriptions of fairies from this village in France 500 years ago, the description will be vastly different from the fairies that, say, my daughters might see in the garden tomorrow. An example of that is modern fairies are almost always described as having wings. Fairies in France 500 years ago, none of them had wings. And so in a sense, they are the mirror of the way our world is evolving at any time. However, in the background of this question, and this might be of more interest to your listeners, there has long been the suspicion, and this was a very strong idea in the early, let's say the late 19th and the early 20th century, that originally fairies were actually a race of humanoids that died out. And that what you have in fairy lore is not something supernatural, but it's the last glimmers, the last memories of races that lived near humans, but outside the human world. And so, for example, the whole studies of Homo sapiens suggesting that there are other species of Homo sapiens, I mean, something which now I think is accepted by all biological anthropologists, that there are species that evolved alongside us but then died out, as, say, Neanderthals did. Is it possible that fairies are not supernatural, that all of this stuff about my daughter seeing fairies is guff, but what actually we have here is a kind of a memory, an ancestral memory of earlier peoples. And many of your listeners will associate fairies particularly with Ireland, with Scotland, with Wales. Is it possible that even up until, I'm not saying the 1800s, but as late as 600 or 700 AD, fairy peoples, a physical race of, I won't say human beings, but humanoids survived in the countryside, living side by side with human beings? Personally, I'm pretty suspicious of this point of view, but I have to say, I always find it fascinating when I read about it. I like the idea. I like the poetry of the idea that fairies were once an actual humanoid species like us.
Yeah, it's really something to consider. You know, most of the encounters that I read, and I did read some of the case studies that you have jotted down in a number of articles, but most of the encounters seem positive. Do we have on record any encounters that were less than positive, or perhaps somebody gets hurt or violently yelled at by a fairy?
Right. I always think one of the best words to describe a fairy is ambivalent. In other words, fairies can be very good or they can be very bad. And typically, the older accounts there are, typically the worse fairies are, whereas more modern accounts tend to see fairies as being quite positive. However, even in medieval times, there were accounts that were very positive, and still today you get accounts that are, frankly, creepy as hell. And in the fairy census, I should mention, by the way, that your listeners, I've published it free online, so this is something that anyone can just go download into PDF and read. In the fairy census, I'll give you one of the ones that I find the creepiest. There is a description of a woman who finds herself in a wood. I think it is. It's in one of the southern U.S. states. I don't. It's not Mississippi, but it's in that general area in the south. And she's in a national park. And she sees a father and two children by the river, and she is conscious of a fairy-like creature who seems to be associated with the river, and the fairy seems to be sniffing around these children. And the account, the children and the parent then walks off. They don't seem to be aware of the fairy, or maybe the children are slightly. But this fairy-like creature is described as a predator. It's described as something that wants to take, maybe to devour the children. And it's interesting that in accounts, fairies that are associated with water tend to be creepier. They tend to be nastier. And there is always this underlying tension in a certain number of accounts about fairies that fairies are, you know, fairies are a little bit, we're not quite sure what they want, and they don't necessarily want something good. And that's particularly true of accounts from children that I'm particularly interested in. And very often children describe having encounters with fairies at night in their bedroom. And very often the children, particularly at the beginning, are scared of the fairies. And they will say, the fairies wanted to take me away, so I screamed for my mother. These kind of stories.
I love that. Physical makeup. You know, you mentioned that hundreds of years ago, the fairies had wings. And then as the times have progressed, the accounts are of beings that do not have wings.
Yeah, sorry, Cliff. It's the opposite there. It's gone from beings not having wings.
Oh, pardon me.
It's the other way around. So as time has gone by, it's more and more likely that fairies will be seen as having wings. And I've always found this a fascinating question. Why?
Yeah, why is that? Why?
Well, I'll take a step back here. When you introduced me, you said I'm interested in the supernatural generally, and that's true. And this is true of all supernatural beings. Supernatural beings change through time. So, for example, the ancient Greeks had an idea of what ghosts were like. The medieval French, the medieval British had an idea of what ghosts were like. We have an idea of what ghosts should be like, and they're all different. And even on, I mean, this is something which is much more recent, but even if you look at encounters that people have with aliens in UFO accounts, over the decades, the descriptions of aliens have changed, and you can pick out trends in these descriptions. So the first thing to say is supernatural creatures, mysterious creatures have always changed through the centuries. And my answer to this would be they change because our imagination changes. These creatures are products, not necessarily products of our imagination, but they, let's put it like this, they are seen through the filter of our imagination. And we are pre-prepared to see these creatures in a certain way. And no surprise, we see them in a certain way. And so children in that village in France 500 years ago, if they'd seen a fairy, they would have seen something like the elves in Lord of the Rings. If a child today sees a fairy, they will see something which is a bit bigger than a butterfly and that has wings.
Is there any accounts that you have found where a fairy has sat with somebody and said, this is what we're about, and we have been interacting with you for centuries, thousands of years, or is there any kind of a historical notion that comes from fairy folk?
I mean, again, the fascinating thing here is that the accounts change over the years, over the centuries. However, if you look at the more recent ones, you have definite, what I would reluctantly call shamanic experiences, where you have people who, when they're very young, begin a relationship with fairies and spirits, and that relationship will continue through their life. And at that point, in other words, they have their first sightings when they're 5 or 6, but they continue to have these sightings when they're teenagers, when they're in their 20s, when they're in their 40s, and often when they're pensioners. And there are lots of people in this category, and they're perhaps one of the most interesting categories. And these people have, let's say, a lifelong conversation with fairies, often with one fairy. And if you like, it's a marriage. Shamanic accounts often talk about a marriage between the witch doctor and a spirit, and their marriages, the person has a relationship that continues over the years, and over the years they come to a conclusion about what fairies are for, and usually this has to do with the idea that fairies are natural spirits, that they are the spirits of the landscape around us. Okay. And I don't know about you, Cliff, but I grew up in the countryside. I live now in the countryside here in Italy. Mm-hmm. And though I'm pretty skeptical about people having supernatural experiences, in the nicest possible way, I have been fascinated since I was a child, since I was 6 or 7, by the way that certain places have an atmosphere. And the people who see fairies will agree with me on that, and they will claim that these atmospheres have to do with fairies or other supernatural creatures dwelling in those places.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. No, it's curious that the work that you've done covers fairies in the UK and also in what is presently known the United States. Is there a difference between the two areas? Are the fairies that are in England, in Ireland, different than the ones that we find here in the United States?
Right. Well, I think I should start by saying that I am a coward. I mean, I've only really studied fairies in the UK and Ireland, and I've been interested in fairies in the US. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. But above all, I'm interested, I suppose, in European fairies, and particularly British and Irish fairies, or let's say European type fairies that are seen in the US. Now, again, this is cowardice, pure cowardice. Fairies are seen in every country, including in the country where I am now, Italy. And I think that when I started out, I wanted to study things in depth. However, as I've gone along, and particularly as I've had people write in for the fairy census, I've become increasingly aware that there are these regional differences. And to go back to your point about, is there a difference between the UK and the US? Well, there are very European-like fairies in the US, but there are also, and a colleague of mine who I think you would enjoy talking to, Peter Muse, who is a folklorist who specializes in New England, has pointed out the way that actually in New England folklore and New England supernatural experiences, people see not just European fairies, but the fairies of the Amerindians, the Indian populations that preceded Europeans, that then survived alongside them in some cases. And these fairies today, these Indian fairies, let's say, are seen in native communities, in First Nation communities, but they're also seen actually by Europeans. So you have this kind of nice blend there of, can we call them hybrid fairies, I suppose, half European, half Indian fairies?
Hmm. Okay. This is very, very interesting. You have a number of questions and replies on the website, the Fairiest, yeah. Which, by the way, those of you listening, Simon has composed the website, Fairiest. I will post it on the Facebook page, which will be on the website. And he has a tremendous amount of research that he's done on this website and references and links and to his articles. And he's written a number of articles. But one of the things that I'm reading right now is, how should you behave among fairies? And it actually says your response is never drink, never eat, and never dance. That's curious to me, because I would think that the fairies are very jovial folk and love to see that kind of thing. So can you explain that a little bit?
I certainly can. I mean, I'm referring here to European traditions, traditions that basically say this, that if you stumble upon fairies having a good time, or worse still, if a fairy somehow manages to lure you, and that's the correct word, I mean carefully chosen, into their world, they want to keep you there. That's their end game, and so they basically have three ways of keeping you there. The first way is to get you to eat something that they're having at one of their feasts. The second way is to get you to drink a glass of wine. And the third way is to get you to dance with them. And so, I mean, by all means, if one of your listeners stumbles into fairy world tomorrow, you can imagine the side of the hill opens in Nebraska. Well, no, that's the worst state to have a side of a hill, sorry. The side of the hill opens somewhere in Rhode Island. You walk into this fairyland, there will be, I guarantee you, a feast. There will be, I guarantee you, dancing. And by all means, stay and have a good time. But when the beautiful woman with the long eyelashes bends over you and offers you a glass of wine, you say no. And if she insists, you pretend to drink it and you just let it dribble down your chin. Because if you digest that stuff, folklore tells us it is over. You are going to spend eternity as a servant of the fairies. So this is something that you do not want to happen.
Oh, my God. Now, that's pretty alarming to hear.
Be careful. Be careful.
So humans become the fairies' servant if you partake in their liquids or some kind of a brain drug. It must do a lot of other things too. That's a fascinating thought. You're the only one I've really seen the take it to an academic level. Is there something about these fairies that we need to take as a message for humanity? In other words, here are these beings that we see in natural settings, they're protectors or they're supporting the nature's growth and things like that. Is it that we need to see them as a lighter part of humanity, or is it more that these are a reminder that we need to have an open and more of a childlike perspective on our lives?
Wow. Well, I mean, that's a deep question. And it's one of those questions that I wonder if I'm really, you know, this is where we really need someone who sees fairies, has these fairy experiences. But for what it's worth, I'm going to give you my take on this. And, you know, you can do with it what you wish. I've always had a great deal of respect for the natural world, for the environment around us. And I think that what fairies teach is respect. I think that's really what all of these stories are about, going all the way back to Roman times and certainly going back earlier, if only we had the written records. They are ways that we are telling ourselves that this world that is around us needs to be respected. And if it's treated well and with respect, we will survive. Maybe we'll be happy, maybe we won't. But if we start to mess with it, if we start to forget it's there, if we start to disrespect it, then, you know, we are risking big time. And I think that that's true if you're a peasant in medieval France, because if you disrespect the world around you, your crop is not going to come in. Your family will starve. The stakes are very, very high. And if we disrespect the world around us today, I think there's the danger that we just disconnect entirely from the planet and we become digital beings. We become virtual beings that spend all our time with podcasts, with Facebook, with Twitter. Wonderful as these things are. But, you know, they ground us. The fairies are saying, come back, be a part of the world, and not just the streets, not just the subways, but the wilder spaces, the buildings, the old buildings. That would be my take on it, if it's not too mystical or pseudo mystical.
No, I like that. That's quite compelling. You've studied this for a long time. It's almost like the fairies are like the Bigfoot. I mean, we see pictures of the Bigfoot. We have hair samples. We have foot impressions of these Bigfoot, but nobody has ever gotten a skeleton or a dead body or whatever. I mean, would you say that it's almost the same kind of a deal where here we have people believing they've seen these little beings and they're being supernatural in some respect? Is that kind of the same deal where they're there, but for some reason we're just not allowed to take them completely in?
Yeah, look, listen, I mean, I'd answer this simply, and at the risk of annoying some of your listeners, I'm fascinated by Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and I have been since I was 6 or 7. I've always found it, you know, very, very just intriguing, something that keeps me reading, and still today I'm fascinated by accounts. But if someone put a gun to my head and said, what is Bigfoot? What is a Sasquatch? I just say a Native American fairy, which has been absorbed into American culture. And I do agree that with the whole Sasquatch and Bigfoot thing, you do have these physical remains allegedly. And again, I'm a skeptic about these things. I'm not sure how to interpret those, but I will be modest enough to say I don't know enough to feel confident enough to give a strong view on that. But all my instincts, I mean, just as we're speaking now, all my instincts are crying out that what you have in the case of Bigfoot and Sasquatch is a Native American fairy that has been absorbed into North American culture. And that when I was talking before about fairies teaching us to respect the world around us, I mean, this is pretty much what I would say that Bigfoot and Sasquatch is about. They are the spirit of the wild. They are a message for humanity from the wild. They're a conversation we're having with the great open spaces.
Wonderful. We're getting down to our time. Just a couple of more questions. Has anyone written down a language or taken some writing or is there anything that we know of that's called fairy language or fairy writing or a document from them?
I've over the years, I've collected a few references to this because it's always intrigued me. And usually fairies speak the same language. There are very few cases where someone speaks to a fairy and they don't understand them. Sometimes, though, you do get accounts of fairies speaking with high-pitched voices, and I'm not really sure what that's about. There are lots of supernatural accounts that associate supernatural beings with whirring sounds, and I've sometimes wondered if this has something to do with this high-pitched noise. I'm not really sure. Another thing that you get with fairies is fairies are always very old-fashioned. Typically, let's go back to this village in France in 1500. If people in that village see fairies, they will be dressed like people would have been 200 years before. So fairies are always wearing older clothes, and in many accounts, fairies speak with an older language. Maybe they speak with old-fashioned English, say, or maybe they speak Gaelic, at a time when Gaelic, the language of Ireland or northwestern Scotland, is dying out. So one thing you can count on fairies to do is to be traditionalists.
Fascinating. Can you, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, Simon, can you give us one of the best examples that you personally like of a fairy interaction?
Okay, well, I think I said to you before that I'm particularly fascinated by children having experiences or adults remembering experiences when they were children. And I'll just give you one that I don't know why, but I just can't get it out of my head. This one comes from New York. But I think it comes from New York State rather than the city. And it's from a girl who is now, I believe, in her 30s. And she was remembering how when she was younger, from about the age of 6 to 9, there were a series of luminous beings who would come to her bedroom window at night, and they had a secret signal. And she describes them, and I there's always this slightly creepy underside to fairies, I think. And she describes them as having, and perhaps you can help me with the words here, I'm not very good with cloves, but they have kind of clingy cloves that accentuates their bodies.
Like leotards or something?
Right, thank you. Yeah. This is the kind of word I was looking for. Something like this. So they're not naked, but they almost might as well be. And they take this girl, and with this girl, they fly around the area together. And so she's able to see things from on high. And this was something that went on for about 3 years. And at a certain point, it ended. And so she had this memory that was largely positive of this childhood experience, but not a one-off thing, something that she'd done time and time again, and that had been something important for a period of her life. And I'm particularly fascinated, I think, by people, particularly children, who've had relationships, if you like, with fairies. In other words, it's not just that they have one weird encounter, but that the fairy keeps coming back. And I'm sure that we've all come across cases in our own life where children that we know have invisible friends. Wow. And that, I mean, the parallel there is fascinating. Now, most psychologists who look at this, in fact, refer to invisible friends as imaginary friends, which is fair enough. But I always feel that's a little bit disrespectful, not least because so many of these grown children who are now adults are really quite adamant that these friends for them were real. And so this is something that's always, I guess, fascinated me. And I've given you there my favorite case of something like that.
Wonderful. I really appreciate that. The book we are talking about today is Magical Folk, British and Irish Fairies, 500 AD to the Present. My guest has been Dr. Simon Young. Simon, what would you like people to take away from this book? I mean, it's quite a bit of information. It's quite detailed. What would you feel like you've achieved what would you like people to get?
Right. Well, I think first of all, I should say that this book is the physical twin of another book. So there are two books together, both of which are available. Now, The other book is The Fairy Census, which is available online. Mm-hmm. And if your readers just type in, I mean, on Facebook, that you'll have the link. But if they just type in Fairy Census on Google, they will come to the page and they'll be able to download. And 3 or 4 minutes from now, they will be able to start reading. You know, I think is it 160,000 words of fairy accounts. And that book for me is just showing. I want to share with people. I want people to actually be able to look at these fairy accounts and come to their own conclusions, hopefully, to use a fairy word, lure some people in and get some of your listeners perhaps to give their own accounts to me through the fairy census. As far as Magical Folk, which is the physical copy of the book, I mean, for me, this book, is this a rude way to say it? You'll tell me, Cliff. I mean, for me, it's a gateway drug. I want to get people interested in fairies. And I and my co-editor, Kerry, who did the book, we got about 18 experts together, each of whom wrote a chapter on fairies in different parts of Britain, different parts of Ireland, and in different parts of North America. And what we wanted to do with all these different voices was, I suppose, you know, it's inevitable. If you get 18 people at a party, there will be three people who irritate you, but there will also be three people who fascinate. And my hope is that some of your listeners, I mean, there may be listeners who have been really annoyed by me, but there will be other people in the book who speak to them, who speak their language, who have their way of seeing the world. And so, yeah, I like this idea. It's a gateway drug to the land of fairies. You'll read this, and it will bring you, I hope, to other books, maybe even in some cases to experiences or to the reevaluation of memories. That's the way I look at it. So there are these two books, one that you can buy, hopefully on a good online seller, Magical Folk, that I and Kerry edited. And then one which is just this gift to the world, The Fairy Census, which is online. And just so your listeners know, I'm presently gathering material together for a second fairy census. I've got about 100 accounts so far. And when I get, probably it'll take me a couple of years, to 500 accounts, I will then release the second fairy census.
You must be considered the foremost authority on these wee folk, yes?
Well, I think what's a little bit unusual about me is perhaps I cover a lot of different areas to do with fairies, but there are some very, very good writers out there. And, you know, between you and me and your listeners, there are some better writers than me in terms of their insight. And I mean, for example, I might mention there's a brilliant British writer named Jeremy Hart, who has written some very, very good stuff on fairies. So there's a world out there to discover if you're interested. And again, I would invite you to look at Magical Folk, and I hope to some extent that book would open that world for you.
Right. And by the way, those of you listening, it is available on Amazon. I just saw it here. It came out in January. It was published in the UK in January, and we're hoping that it's readily available, which I think it is, on Amazon US. So fantastic.
Just so you know, Cliff, I sent a couple of copies to my American cousins, and I had no problems doing that with Amazon. I think that technically speaking, it has not been published in the US, but it is very much available in the US. And in fact, so far, there seems almost to have been more interest in the US than in the UK. I mean, we've had a good reaction in the UK, but honestly, the warmest emails I've got so far, I would say, have been from the US.
Fantastic. Simon Young, it's been a pleasure. Continued success. I imagine that this is not going to stop for you. You've got this in your system. We'll probably see a number of books in the next few years.
I'm in the middle of a couple of other books. I'm preparing a supernatural atlas of Britain at the moment. So there are lots of projects going on, and I hope in a couple of years we can talk again.
Yeah, we'll definitely have you back if you're doing Supernatural Britain, because that's something that I probably would like to talk to you about. So fantastic. Simon, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. It's great to talk.
I was pleasantly surprised at his openness, Simon's openness to discuss the great details of this work. And obviously, he is an academic who has taken great interest in these odd kind of creatures, if you want to call them that, humanoids, and their fantastic appearances, random appearances in different parts of the world. So that was fun. Go check out his different websites. The Fairy Census is available to download for free. And all you got to do is just type in Fairy Census, C-E-N-S-U-S, and it is huge. And it has articles and things like that that you can check out. Also, he is the person behind a fairy website. It's called The Fairiest, F-A-I-R-Y-I-S-T.com. And that has a ton of articles that he's written. It has the different types of fairies that have been reported throughout the world. And it has things like information. It's the biggest collection of fairy sightings ever assembled. There's over 400 of those sightings that you can read about. And he has articles that he's written. He's pretty prolific when it comes to writing articles about it. So he's very much engaged and really fun having him on the program. Now, he's writing some new books on other unusual humanoid type of creatures that we're going to highlight later in the year. Actually, one book's going to come out, I think, in December. So we'll definitely have Simon back. Dr. Simon Young. Wonderful to have him on the program. Okay, remember, next week is Richard Casero talking about the Maya and other ancient cultures in Central America. That is always fun. And please consider a subscription to Patreon. Go to patreon.com/earthancients and sign up for a subscription to support Earth Ancients. We'd love it. It helps us keep growing. That's it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we will talk to you next week.